Here are the stories we're covering this week in the Category5.tv newsroom. As if we needed another reason not to trust Kaspersky, it was discovered that their antivirus injected a unique ID that allows sites to track users even in incognito mode. Ubuntu 19.10 will offer an experimental ZFS file system option. There's a new attack exploiting serious Bluetooth weakness that is capable of intercepting sensitive data. And if this, then that warns against migrating Nest devices to Google accounts. These stories are coming right up. Don't go anywhere.
This is the Category5.tv newsroom, covering the week's top tech stories with a slight Linux bias.
I'm Sasha Rickman, and here are the top stories we're following this week. As if we needed another reason not to trust Kaspersky, it was discovered that their antivirus injected a unique ID that allowed sites to track users, even in incognito mode. Antivirus software is something that can help people be safer and more private on the internet, but its protections can cut both ways. A case in point, for almost 4 years, AV products from Kaspersky Lab injected a unique identifier into every website a user visited, making it possible for sites to identify people even when using incognito mode or even when they switch to a different browser. The identifier was part of a blob of JavaScript Kaspersky products injected into every page a user visited. The JavaScript was designed to, among other things, present a green icon that corresponded to safe links returned in search results. Ronald Eichenberg, a reporter for CT Magazine, who broke the story, found something unsettling about the JavaScript injected by the Kaspersky product installed on his test computer, a big long tag that looked like a serial number. He investigated and found it was unique to his machine, and it was injected into every single page he visited. It didn't matter if he used Chrome, Firefox, Edge, or Opera, or whether he turned on incognito browsing. The identifier acted as a unique identification number that website operators could use to track him. Kaspersky stopped sending the identifier in June after Eichenberg privately reported the behavior to the AV company. The identifier was introduced in 2015. That meant for close to 4 years, all consumer versions of Kaspersky software for Windows, including the free version, Kaspersky Internet Security, and Kaspersky Total Security, silently branded users with a unique ID.
Oh, dear.
So, and then sold all of that? I feel like that's the next step.
But that's the thing, is that they were providing a means for attackers to track users. They weren't necessarily tracking the users. They could have been.
Right.
But they were injecting a unique identifier into every website that someone visited. So if a malicious party figured that out.
Yeah.
Which I'm sure they did. We're not hearing about that aspect. We're hearing about it now that it's been made public knowledge and fixed four years later. But I guarantee you it was exploited.
But the intention was probably not malicious. It was just an oversight. Not that, like,
as a programmer,
ignorance isn't innocent.
As a programmer, I would say that that was an intern who made a real bonehead move and is no longer with the company. That's, like, my programmer standpoint is, like, that was a bonehead move.
Right.
Stupid. But companies make those kinds of stupid decisions sometimes.
Mm-hmm. Well, it makes me wonder if there's even the possibility somebody started to put that in there as part of maybe an analytics to be able to track how it usage data, all that kind of stuff, so that they can, you know, fix the program if something goes wrong. But it's like, come on.
Mm-hmm.
Like, are people still using Kaspersky?
Unfortunately, the unknowing public do tend to still use whatever is presented to them.
Somebody please share this. Yeah. Share it to all your friends.
Yeah.
Stop. Just stop.
That kind of programming mistake from a security company is not acceptable.
No, it's not.
Okay, so that's the thing, because it's a security company, right? So if it's just a regular blunder from some other company, but it's a security company, like, you really should know better.
I mean, we take for granted that these products are out there to protect us, but should there not be an absolute evaluation and auditing process for any feature that's added to a security product that could potentially exploit the user.
Right.
See, and I guess this is just kind of the tangent that my brain goes off. But I look at stuff like this and I go, if it was that easy for one company to inject this ID, it opens up the door to go, how many other people are going to go, ooh, that was easy to do.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm going to do that.
Yeah, here's like, a free add-on for your computer that gives you whatever.
Well, yeah, and I mean, like, you think of people who are like, oh, the government's tracking you. Literally, all they've got to do is done. Like, you know everything about everybody.
Yeah, guess like who else is tracking you. Yeah, and that becomes personally identifiable. It's like, and I don't mean to take up so much time, Sasha, but it is like that, the mall surveillance system that they said was not personally identifying people, right? But at the same time, as soon as you see, oh yeah, that's Sasha Rickman right there, then as I see the surveillance video that's going through the mall, I know what she's wearing. Oh yeah, even though I can't make out her face, you know, I'm better than AI, I can see that's Sasha Rickman,
mm-hmm.
right? So is it personally identifiable? Oh no, it's just a UUID. Well, log into your Gmail. Guess where that UUID is injected.
Yeah, exactly.
Now it's associated with your Gmail account. It's associated with your email address and your contact list.
Yeah.
So it's associated with your Facebook and your Twitter profile.
Exactly. So, but now they're not doing it any longer, which means that it was probably...
In that way. They've hidden their tracks.
Yeah.
But...
We don't trust Kaspersky at this point.
No.
Yeah.
The damage is done. People should really just back away.
Is there a way to stop that kind of tracking, though? Like, what? I mean, we've got all these, you know, protection suites, like antivirus, malware, all that kind of stuff. Is there any way to create, like, a tracking ID suite that goes, oh, we found these trends, we're wiping that out? Like, how do you stop against that?
I mean, the correct answer is Tor. Like, that's the...
Fair enough.
That's... But, you know, is that legitimate for... The average user?
No, it's not.
Not really.
Mm-hmm.
And can that be exploited? Well, we've heard stories that, there are ways that it has been exploited. We'll see.
Right.
I don't know if there's an easy answer.
Off the grid. But that's just, why would you do that? You're walking away from
that. That's not an option. It's not an option.
So moving right along. Ubuntu 19.10 will offer an experimental ZFS file system option. The newly announced plan, which isn't set in stone, is to include a ZFS install option in Ubuntu 19.10, the next short-term release due this October. The downside is that using ZFS on Linux distributions is a little tricky. The format is tangled up with all sorts of licensing issues. But those issues haven't put Canonical off. Canonical states that they have, quote, spent time looking at the licensing which applies to the Linux kernel and to ZFS and concluded that we are acting within the rights granted and in compliance with the terms on both licenses. End quote. Feeling it's well worth its rights to use the ZFS fully, the company plowed away on bringing up ZFS file system support for Ubuntu across the cloud, server, and containers for several years. Now it's coming to the desktop.
Okay. See, I can see it really working well on the server. Why such a need to bring it to the desktop? I guess we gotta be, you know, up and up.
I guess.
Doesn't ZFS require... this is a question maybe for our community. Doesn't it require, or doesn't it suggest the need for like higher end hardware, like ECC RAM and that kind of stuff? Like, is that not an issue? And I ask that, I don't really know the answer to that. Mm-hmm. So is it not a little bit of a dangerous thing to be presenting it to the end users? And they'll call it experimental.
Right.
So, you know, don't run this if you don't know what it is. But right. If you're running it on consumer hardware that you bought at Walmart, mm-hmm. is that a good idea?
Why would somebody want to be using it?
Well, because it has certain advantages to the server, and that's where on the desktop, like we're talking like redundant file storage, the ability to go back on file versioning and things like that, stuff that EXT3, EXT4 is not that good at because it's older.
Right.
Right? So this is a more streamlined, futuristic file system.
Right.
But tricky for the common person to use.
Well, to deploy. But if they ease the deployment process, make it a part of the installer, well, then it's not so much of a big deal. The Foo said ZFS doesn't need anything extra unless you actually need that extra stuff. So I think what they're saying is you don't have to add those features that are going to be problematic if you don't need them, which means the average user is probably not going to add them.
Right.
So it's not going to be a problem.
And if you were going to be adding them, you would know what you were adding, and then you would know
yeah,
how
precisely.
To. And,
yeah, okay. The Foo goes on to say ZFS still validates that what was sent to the disk actually got there. And that's important for sure. How does it handle like power outages and things like that? That's the, you know, there are so many questions about file systems that I don't know the answers to, because that's like hot, like really low level stuff. And the Foo says ECC is recommended but not necessary. But that's where maybe end users, like if I don't know the answers and maybe the community doesn't know the answers, maybe it's best to stick with like ext4 for the desktop. Or maybe ButterFS, at least stuff that's like, I don't know.
I put butter on my bread.
I love butter on my bread. And butter on my file system. I like it.
There's a new attack exploiting serious Bluetooth weakness that is capable of intercepting sensitive data. Researchers have demonstrated a serious weakness in the Bluetooth wireless standard that could allow hackers to intercept keystrokes, address books, and other sensitive data sent from billions of devices. Dubbed Key Negotiation of Bluetooth, or KNOB for short, the attack forces two or more devices to choose an encryption key just a single byte in length before establishing a Bluetooth connection. Attackers within radio range can then use commodity hardware to quickly crack the key. From there, attackers can use the cracked key to decrypt data passing between the devices. The types of data susceptible could include keystrokes passing between a wireless keyboard and a computer, address books uploaded from a phone to a car dashboard, or photographs exchanged between phones. KNOB doesn't require an attacker to have any previously shared secret material or to observe the pairing process of the targeted devices. The exploit is invisible to Bluetooth apps and the operating systems that they run on, making the attack almost impossible to detect without highly specialized equipment. KNOB also exploits a weakness in the Bluetooth standard itself. That means, in all likelihood, that the vulnerability affects just about every device that's compliant with the specification. The researchers have simulated the attack on 14 different Bluetooth chips, including those from Broadcom, Apple, and Qualcomm, and found them all to be vulnerable.
Okay.
So, no longer trust your wireless devices?
I don't mind turning off my Bluetooth.
Right.
I was going to say, I have my watch. I never turn my Bluetooth off.
Yeah.
Ever.
So when I'm at a public coffee house, how do I know I can trust the individuals that are nearby?
Right.
How do you know you can trust the coffee at that coffee house?
How can you afford coffee?
Well, because it's a good coffee house, Jeff.
Okay.
I'm part of the loyalty program.
Okay. So Bluetooth, they can just tap on into Bluetooth, but they couldn't, like, tap into it and then go everywhere. They can just tap into the one thing?
Well, presumably it's the communication,
yeah.
The data. So what is being sent to your
phone?
Your watch?
My steps.
Your steps, your heart rate, chances are your location.
My weight, yeah. Actually.
Yep, all that kind of stuff.
Well,
a lot of your
those things don't concern me, but what about, like, email or phone calls or...
Sure, well, exactly.
Okay, I have
SMS.
All that turned off.
So, okay, well, that's wise.
Yeah.
Well done.
But... The software itself can still access that by turning it on. So it's still possible if they can get to the phone.
Oh, the software can enable
it?
Oh,
yeah.
I see. Yeah. And we live in a society where we are plagued with phishing scams right now.
Right.
So the moment that a compromising party can gain access to your contact list, right, or information about your contacts or people that you interact with, then they can spoof that.
Mm-hmm.
They can use specialized hardware, if they're good, to spoof an SMS sender and make it look like it's coming from a family member.
Right.
And, click on this link, and it takes you to a thing that installs ransomware, which is a real thing on phones now, and certainly on computers. So get a hold of your email address list and things like that. People are way too trusting because it came from a family member. It came from a friend. I've said, like, what if you got an email from me that said open this attachment?
I would probably immediately open it.
You might open it if you really firmly believed it was from me because the email address matched, the name matched. Even these days, the signature matches.
Yeah.
Everything is, it's very, very clever.
I got an email a week ago from somebody that I trust dearly.
Mm.
And the subject line was, check this out.
Yeah.
So I'm like, yeah, okay.
Mm-hmm.
I open it up. It's just a link.
Yeah.
Oh.
And I'm like, yeah, okay. So I texted them, the person. I'm like, yeah, you've been hacked. Like, what are you talking about? Like, I just got this email, so check that out. So like, no, I actually sent that. And I'm like, it's the first time it looked like a scam.
Wow.
There wasn't.
Dude, you really need to improve your emails
exactly.
Because it totally looks like a scam.
I'll sometimes text people links to things.
Yeah.
But I always add a description of what I'm
right,
sending.
Yeah.
But they're still sophisticated. I got one the other day. It's like, I don't know if you saw, this is happening. You don't want it to happen. I did some research on it. Here's what you need to know. This is where I found the research.
Yeah.
Sure.
And it was something related to what the two of us are involved in. And I was like, I almost clicked it. I'm going, wait a minute.
Yeah.
This guy knows nothing about technology.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
There's no way he would talk about this.
Right. So they get a hold of your contact list through this Bluetooth exploit, as an example.
Yep.
And now they find out that, oh, you interact with Robbie Ferguson. Ah, okay. Grab one of the emails from that Robbie Ferguson because of the Bluetooth connection gives them access to that as well. And now they can spoof my signature so it looks exactly like it's coming from me, spoof my email address, and send you a link that says click here and signs it by Robbie to make it look completely legit, right?
So what if it was flipped? What would you do if you got a message from me that said, like, oh my goodness, Robbie, I need your help. I don't know what I've done.
Send money.
No, I don't know what I've done. And then there's a link.
Yeah.
That sounds like me. That actually sounds like something I would say. Would you click it or would you call me and see whether or not I sent it?
I would probably, because of my experience, be able to determine from the URL that you've sent whether or not it's legit.
Oh, real?
Not only that, you would send that through Discord.
But that's me.
I would ask the whole world. Yeah.
Yeah, but that's not always the case. But so what I do in those cases when I'm not entirely sure is I wget it. And I watch the headers and I see if...
wget it?
Yeah. So I don't open it in a browser. I open it in a Linux terminal that allows me to follow the header flow so that I can see, was it actually giving me a file? Oh, this actually redirected and redirected and redirected until finally it gave me a JavaScript file. And then I open that JavaScript file in a text editor to see what it was actually doing. And
oh,
I find
so smart.
And I find eval codes. And so I decode the eval codes and see the actual JavaScript that is being run. So what would I do? It's not average.
Yeah. Well, this is why I'm asking you what you would do. Because what
Robbie would
do...
Robbie would go on a detective mission.
Yeah.
What I would do is like 14 seconds after I've done whatever I'm not supposed to do, feel like, oh, that was probably the wrong choice.
Like hitting the reset button.
I should call Robbie and send him this link and be like, I clicked this link. Is it safe?
So I think rather than what would I do, let's think about what we wouldn't do.
Yes.
So if you get an email, this is happening right now, this is being distributed, an email from a colleague or somebody that you know that looks like it's legit, it's got their signature, it's got their email address and everything else, but it's got a zip file attached to it, and the zip file is encrypted, because presumably it's private.
Right.
This is, here's some private information, so I zipped it and I encrypted it. The password is blah, 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 blah. One thing, nobody who has any brains to encrypt something is going to send the password in the same email as the encrypted file. Okay, so just think about that for a second. Hold on, back up, whether you think you know them or not. Nobody's going to do that if they have the mindset to know that they need to encrypt the file. Think about that for a second. Right? If you... so why would a malicious party then encrypt a file and create a zip file that is password protected and then give you the password? Because an antivirus product, be it on a server or your own computer, cannot read encrypted data. Okay. So that zip file coming into your inbox. Into your inbox, it's password protected and encrypted. So without the password, it can't be opened and therefore can't be scanned. It will scan the file, but it won't find anything wrong with it because it's just a bunch of ones and zeros. It can't read the actual data, So then you open the zip file, especially on Microsoft Windows, open that zip file, enter the password that was in the email so cleverly, because your friend is so security-minded, and boom, it comes up and you're infected with ransomware and the whole network is gone. You've lost all the files for the company and you feel pretty bad about that, I'm pretty sure. So what do you do? Okay, so you get that email, it's got a password-protected zip file. Mm-hmm. Regardless of whether you think you trust it or not, you call that person. You say, Sasha, did you just send me a password-protected zip file? What are you going to say?
No.
No? What are you talking about?
Yeah.
Delete. Okay?
There
Done.
You go.
Problem solved. It's just doing your due diligence.
I wish there was a way for email service companies to come up with a hit 'em back button. So when you get those kind of emails, you go, hit them back.
Oh, yeah.
And just shoot something out.
This is spam. This is malware. Hack them back.
Exactly. And shut them down.
And it bombards them. Like there are Russian servers that it's all tapped in together.
That's what we need.
That would be handy.
There we go.
On the next episode.
There's my billion-dollar product idea.
There you go. Oh, it's been shut down already, Jeff.
If this then that warns against migrating Nest devices to Google accounts. Google says it's moving Nest devices over to a unified Google ecosystem for the sake of simplicity. But simple can be complicated, as is certainly the case here. In May, after users fought the decision, the company announced that it would maintain Works with Nest connections for some third-party integration. If this then that, or IFT, applets for the company's camera, smoke detector, and thermostat are among those exceptions. That certainly bodes well for those users who took the time to ingrate IFT functionality. However, users who opt to migrate a Nest account to a Google one will break their connections in the process. IFT said in a statement, quote, "Do not migrate your Nest account to a Google account. Migrating your Nest account will cause IFT and other Works with Nest integrations to be disconnected. This process is not reversible." Further, they warn users, do not disconnect Nest from IFT after August 31st, as you will not be able to reconnect it. This affects users that do not migrate their Nest accounts to a Google one, end quote. For its part, Google says that it's looking to bring similar automation functionality to Nest that presently requires third-party integration from services like IFT.
Mm-hmm. A couple of sides of this. I mean, you want to jump on them and say, Google's trying to cut out the little guy.
Mm.
That was my first reaction. Then I realized, okay, well, there have been exploits on Nest.
Yep.
There have been hacks on Nest. And so what's the best way to protect Nest users is to control the ecosystem.
Right.
To stop the API that allows third-party integrations. That's a tough situation when you've created something that supports that from the get-go.
See, and my thought was by, you know, removing that and kind of bringing it back into the centralized process, what happens if there's a data breach?
Well, presumably Google knows about encryption by now.
Right.
You would think, but how many times have we seen big name pumpkins?
Giant pumpkins. Giant pumpkins, folks. October's coming.
That's right. But how many times have we seen big name companies go, oops?
Right.
Like,
yeah.
Because, I mean, in this case,
I could never think that that Google has that.
Okay,
but it's possible.
Now if one thing goes wrong and it's linked back to Google centralizing it and taking the third party out and the middleman out, mm-hmm. then people are going to go, your problem, not ours.
Mm.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, we'll have to see.
I don't know, maybe that's not a big deal to them, but that's
so I guess what it boils down to is the user. Like, are you using IFT? And if you are, for your Nest devices... So that is your Nest thermostat.
Do you have a Nest thermostat?
I have a Nest thermostat.
Do you use the if this then that?
I don't use if this then that with Nest. However, I do use my Amazon Echo. See how I stopped myself?
And you use that? Is that an if-this-then-that situation?
No. The Echo is a third-party integration, however.
Oh, okay.
I would imagine, unless it's like a Google official skill, right? I guess that's something that I'll discover. But I can understand why they'd want to lock down their ecosystem in such a way that they are in control.
Yeah. Right.
But at the same time, it really hurts someone like Ift.
Sure.
But, and what we learned there in your story is that now Google is saying they're going to create their own Ift.
Right. Well, I hope that they buy out the real Ift and give them a whole whack of money for the work they've done.
That
won't happen.
That won't happen.
No.
But it would be nice.
Just free
Give them a bunch of free money just to say thank you for supporting the ecosystem.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe do that.
Yeah.
Because people don't want Ift to switch to Google.
Shareholders don't want that, though.
No, but come on, play nice in this World Wide Web.
Exactly.
Right? If you're going to be the big dog, play nice with the little guys.
Oh, that was kind of naive.
Right.
I'm just saying. I mean,
it would be nice.
What do you think? Please comment below. And this is me. I wanted you to take over, but no, this is actually my turn to talk about the CoinGecko crypto report as of August 21st, 2019. Now, Bitcoin has dropped a little bit, but it's still doing quite well at $10,081.90 fiat USD. Facebook Libra is still not trading.
Yes.
Litecoin is an interesting case this week.
Oh.
Last week, it skyrocketed,
mm-hmm.
like almost doubled in its value, in U.S. dollars value.
Has anybody figured out why?
I don't know why.
The news? Did something come up?
Followed
the news?
Trends, but
it's because we covered it in the news.
Yeah. So it went up. So if you bought like four weeks ago, you did really, really well last week. And I hope you sold, because then it cut down again. So it actually, wow.
So is it lower than it was 2 weeks ago?
Last week it was at 188.37, doing quite well. And this week it lost $115.13.
That's like 65% of its value.
It's now down at $73.24. So I hope you bought after last week's show. Monero is staying pretty static at $80.23 fiat, up 134 from last week. Torque, or previously known as Stellite, it's been doing well for a small coin, sitting now at 1.01 ten-thousandths of a cent, whereas Turtlecoin is about half that at 0.53. Remember, the cryptocurrency market never closes. It's always volatile. It's always changing. And because it's 24/7, you never know. Like Jeff says, well, what caused it to go up and what caused it to come down? You don't know. You can take a guess, but it's not like oil. Like, you can't point it at one particular thing and say that's what caused it. No, it doesn't work that way. It's cryptocurrency. It's madness. So anything you invest, make sure you're ready to lose it.
Lose it.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Please.
Big thanks to Roy W. Nash and our community of viewers for submitting stories to us this week. Thanks for watching the Category5.tv newsroom. Don't forget to like and subscribe for all your tech news with a slight Linux bias. And for more free content, be sure to check out our website. From the Category5.tv newsroom, I'm Sasha Rickman.
And I'm Robbie Ferguson.
And I'm Jeff Weston.